Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
What's good, Internet? It is March 10th, 2017, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio. We are not coming to you live today. We are coming to you from all over the world, from the West Coast, from the East Coast, from coasts you haven't even heard about before. We're Danielle and I are in Boston, and that's not normally where we're at, but we're here for PAX. Are you excited for PAX?
We're doing the PAX thing! Yeah! I'm excited because we have a nice place. You may have seen, we did a Beautiful Cribs episode last night. And you should watch that on the internet if you haven't already.
If you haven't, you can find that on twitter.com/waypoint or at facebook.com/waypointvice. I really just do the whole tour of the entire, just everything. I kind of let you inside of, like, my own heart in some ways. It's kind of a very vulnerable take on Cribs, but I think it's worth watching for me. But like I alluded to, we are also on the West Coast today because joining us is the newest member of Team Waypoint, Rob Zachney. Welcome, Rob.
Yay. How's it going, everybody?
So glad to have you here. Obviously, you joined up last week, and I mentioned that on the Monday cast, but this is the first time that you're actually on Waypoint Radio, and I'm really thrilled to have you here. And I've been trying to figure something out, which is, like, how do you bring someone on to Waypoint Radio? Do you just have, like, a regular episode of the show where we talk about games we've been playing and stuff that's maybe happened in the industry or some deeper topic? Do we talk about politics? Do we talk about who knows what? And then I realized it. We have the number one way to bring you in, to initiate you. We have the question bucket.
Mm.
And so because we're doing this over the internet in an Airbnb, and because we're not doing it live, I figure we're just going to do a kind of a quick and dirty episode where we just dig deep into that old question bucket and see what's going on and give you the opportunity to speak your mind. So welcome, Rob.
I think it's a full immersion baptism by question bucket. I think that's what this is.
It isn't just like a question bucket. It's like a question font. Like,
exactly. Exactly. So, okay. I mean, first off, for me, before we even get into the bucket, I just want to know, Rob, like, who are you? What should people know about you? People who've never heard of you before, who haven't read your great work, or who haven't listened to your many really good podcasts?
What an excitingly, terrifyingly existential question from Editor-in-Chief Austin Walker to start things out. I've been a freelance writer about video games for years and years and years, and that's partly by choice and partly by the fact that I graduated right as the entire economy melted down.
Woo!
Around 2008.
Oh, good.
And so this was kind of a job where, for some reason, people paid me to write about video games, and I was able to make a survivable living doing that, which was a hell of a lot better than what I was doing before, which was lugging beer kegs around a liquor store warehouse. Given the two options, this seemed the way to go. And I've sort of been freelancing ever since. And along the way, I sort of became a specialist in strategy games. And that interest led me to esports later. And I wouldn't present myself as an esports expert because there are people who, like, you know, live and die by esports and breathe the stuff. But, I fell in love with StarCraft, and that interest got me immersed into a lot of different esports scenes. And somewhere in all of that, I started doing podcasts and became addicted to them.
To doing them or listening to them?
Both. I've always been addicted to listening to them. One of the aforementioned terrible jobs I worked before doing this one, my only window into a better life was the Games for Windows radio, GFW radio, mm-hmm. Brodeo.
Yep.
And so that was you know, they were kind of my window into what life could be like outside of my terrible little cubicle. So I was addicted to them as an audience member, but I developed this terrible habit when doing things like the dishes and such of starting to argue with the people on the podcast. And they didn't argue back because they couldn't hear me. It was very much like the end of like Final Fantasy VIII, where you're just sort of screaming into the void, and Renoa just won't hear your trenchant point about BioWare RPGs. So Troy Goodfellow was running Three Moves Ahead, which was a strategy podcast, and he was good enough to invite me on. And that was his first mistake. And once I'd infiltrated the confines of Three Moves Ahead, I launched my bloody coup. And since then, I just haven't been able to stop podcasting. The moment Waypoint started and you created a podcast, I was like, I must have it. I must join this podcast.
Add it to the collection. Add it to the keyring of podcasts.
Yeah, pretty much. Like in my house, there's sort of a portrait of Dorian Gray type thing, okay. But it's like a dude covered in microphones and headsets and like mixing boards. It's pretty grotesque, but it keeps me young and fresh.
And it lets you totally just podcast without any. You don't have a microphone right now. It's like all of the microphones you've ever used are on the portrait, so you can just do it extemporaneously with no equipment needed.
Yeah, like I am always ready.
That sounds podcast. That's part of why we hired you. You know, we figured
it's actually true. It's not even a lie. I think Rob is actually always ready to podcast. Pretty sure.
And you know, for my part, it was definitely listening to you with Three Moves Ahead, and then with Idle Weekend, and just like coming to know your voice as one that was not just credible, but like deeply critical and really self-reflective. Like, I rarely hear you make a statement without also hearing you, like, understand that statement is coming from a place and a time and could possibly require additional input from a different perspective. And that's why you've always been a really great writer, a really great podcaster, and why I'm so happy to have you on the team. So I think instead of lingering here, we should really dig deep into this question bucket and see what happens. So you know what, Rob? Here's what I'm going to need you to do. I need you to give me a number from 1 to, let's say, 100, and we'll start there.
88.
That's definitive. That's a definitive.
Oh, you knew right away.
Okay. Let's see. This one comes in from Andy. Okay. Hey, Point Weighers. I recently listened to the podcast where you expressed your desires to, quote, fall in love with a game, and it made me remember something that I'd rather not. You see, I fell in love with a game called Dragon Age Inquisition whenever that game was released, and it left me with a broken heart. I had so much fun running around with my virtual hunk of a husband, Iron Bull, and I wish the game would never end. Slowly but surely, I felt that the game was nearing its end, and I dreaded it so much because I was in heaven. I didn't want to leave. When I finally completed the game, I felt like crap, because it was over, and I was heartbroken for quite some time afterwards. So my question for the Waypoint relationship crew is, have you ever experienced something, quote, stupid, like this? And if so, how do you protect yourself from unhealthy crushes that will make you feel like crap afterwards? Love the show, Andy. So Rob, how about you? Have you ever had a game crush? Just kind of a deep feeling for a game that when you leave it, it stings.
You know what? That's a great excuse for why I haven't finished The Witcher 3. Let's go with that one. But in terms of like a game where I knew even as I was playing it that this was like a special experience and I didn't want it to end, and I still get this feeling every time I play it, The Last Express, which was a really revolutionary adventure game for its time. It actually still is. It's a very singular game. It's a real-time adventure game set on the last trip of the Orient Express on the eve of World War I. And there's lots of spy drama and intrigue, but really what the game is about is just taking this trip with this train full of archetypes that sort of capture Europe at this explosive moment in its history. And one of the devices this game employs is that your journey is tracked on a map. And so you can always go back to the main menu and you see the bar of your journey sort of filling up as, you know, it connects from like Paris to Strasbourg to Vienna. And so you can sort of get a sense for how much of the game is left and how much time you're going to have left with these characters. And about the halfway point, I was having such an extraordinary time with the game. And I was so utterly captivated by the characters and the story, and it was really provoking a lot of questions. Because I was young enough that, like, the things this game was raising about politics and what an empire looks like to the people inside of it and the people sort of on the receiving end of its power.
This is happening just as World War One is about to kick off, right? That's the background to this is the machinations of a number of international movers and shakers are coming to a head both in Europe and also on this train that's moving through Europe. And it really engages with that stuff in a really like straightforward way, but also in like kind of a gloriously cartoonish way.
You know, not many games can pull this off. Like every character is at once just an amazing stereotype. You know, there's your gauche German industrialist. There's your snobby French conductors who just can't stop talking shit about the other characters. There's the gorgeous and mysterious Balkan spy. And yet, all these characters also, like, very convincingly human. Like, every character has a little detail that you discover about them that, like, instantly complicates the picture and makes you feel some empathy for them. But halfway through this game, I started to realize, like, this is going to end. And not only that, but the ending is going to be horrible. Like, it's the eve of World War One. Like, you already know, this isn't going to have a happy ending.
Right.
Like, you can still kid yourself that maybe it'll work out for your main characters. But broadly speaking, like, all these people are doomed.
Right.
Their order, their way of life, it's all doomed. And so about halfway through this game, like, these relationships are going to end. This magical time inside this confined space was going to end. The real world was going to intrude. And also, I was not going to be able to play this game for the first time ever again.
Right.
And I sort of had this melancholy in advance. And I started doing things like walking through the train and just sort of taking it all in and listening to this conversation. You know what, like, just before you leave a place, right? Just before you, like, leave a community of people, you start loving all of it, even the shit you didn't.
Even the food court?
That's...
Like, even the... Like,
yeah,
totally.
So that's where I was with this game.
Which is, like, doubly good, because that's the thing with that game is that's you playing non-optimally, because that's a game where the clock is always ticking. Where walking around and just listening in and not interceding is how you reach a dead end and then need to turn the clock back and rewind and go through that segment again.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely was, like, counterproductive. But I couldn't help myself. And then the way the game does eventually end is even more of a gut punch.
Right.
And I knew what I was getting into, but it still hit harder than I was expecting. And so it was kind of a crushing, I don't know, in some ways it was like, you know, I was only like 10 or 11, and it was the first time where I started to understand what, like, lost love would be like. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, what losing something sort of irreplaceable would or could be like. I wouldn't know the experience firsthand for a while, but it was sort of a terrifying little preview of, like, oh, so sometimes things don't work out.
Right.
Oh, man.
And you can see it coming.
Welcome to Waypoint. It's all melancholy here. if you want more conversation, if you want more of Rob waxing poetic on The Last Express, there's an incredible Three Moves Ahead episode. Episode 271 on The Last Express, which is Rob Zachney and Troy Goodfellow and Idle Thumbs' own Chris Remo to talk about that.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic episode, even though it's a strategy game podcast. I think you were doing a World War One series.
It was the Centennial,
right.
I think, yeah.
Right, and so really worth listening to. Danielle, how about you? Do you have a game that, like, when you wrapped it up, you stepped back and thought, like, ah, damn, like, this stings to have left it behind?
I had a lot of those feelings about the Mass Effect series, for sure.
Mm.
Maybe not as much in the wrap-up of 3, because I was already sort of primed for, oh, the ending, I played it, you know, at the time, before the ending was patched and all the other whatever shit. I actually thought the ending was fine, but it wasn't, you know, it was more the first and second game that really kind of got me and just had me utterly in love with that world and with the characters. And it was the first time I played Mass Effect 2 first. I loved it so much, I immediately went back and played 1 and then 2 again. It was kind of the first game where I could be like, I don't know, queer, awesome space person. Like, it was the very first time I could actually play that fantasy ever.
Yeah.
And that was so, so powerful for me that I was just like, oh my God, I can I can have this relationship with this amazing space lady. And I can be a cool space lady. And we can solve all the world's problems through diplomacy and Star Trek style, but we can also have wild sex. And it'll be so great and so wonderful. And we can go to strip clubs. I mean, that was maybe not, like, the most biggest selling point. But it was just really exciting to, like, be able to play out that fantasy that I Never.
And there's nothing wilder than a BioWare sex scene.
Oh, boy.
Oh, baby.
Oh, damn.
Let me tell you. You might see a hand on a steamy, you know, window pane.
Yep. Like, oh, you definitely will.
Oh,
your
boy.
Your torso looks very supportive.
Very variations.
With the pointy bras and everything, you know? Like, it's very, you know, the sex scene in the third game for two women is amazing. They're, like, in the shower in bikinis. It is, like...
Is that not, that's not how...
It's great.
Okay.
It's kind of, that's not necessarily, you know, I guess you could, you know, if you wanted to, you couldn't have a cool bikini sex party. Maybe that was
That's what queer women do, Austin. Okay.
Right. That's what women do.
And...
You gotta get, are those like special? Do you have to go to a special store for the sex bikini or is that just...
Yeah, they are. You have to go to the lesbian shower bikini store.
Okay.
That's where you go.
The LSB, yeah. The LSB store. Gotcha.
The LSBS.
The LSBS.
Exactly. LSB Depot.
Okay.
Yep.
Perfect. Good. Yeah.
All right, what about you? What about your case of advanced regret?
It's funny, like, for me, it's actually, you know, the Andy who wrote in said Dragon Age Inquisition, and for me, it's actually a game I didn't think I was very fond of until I wrapped it up, which was Dragon Age Origins, a game that I played over a holiday break. I feel like maybe the first holiday break after I went into grad school. And just completely devoured it. You know, maybe it was, what year was Origins? Was that... was that 2010 or was that 2009?
Oh,
I always forget.
That
makes it, that brings it into better perspective. It was before I went to grad school. It was literally after the economy fell apart for me also, Rob. And I had to move back in with my parents. And it was, I picked it up for myself, like when it came out, it was around Christmas and I was like working some retail jobs, but wasn't like feeling very fulfilled. And then just like 1 week completely devoured it, 80, 90 hours, did every side quest, did everything else. And then like the credits hit and it left me feeling deeply unfulfilled. Partially because I think the end of that game is actually really bad. I think that like the fight against the big bad at the end of that game was, I think there was like a scale to it that's really successful that at kind of suggesting that a big battle is happening. And there are stakes because you care about the world, but the antagonist is, I don't know, the antagonist is just, that series has had an antagonist problem until the DLC of Inquisition. That's the first time that there had ever been an antagonist that I think really works. And the antagonist of Dragon Age Origins is especially bad because it's just kind of a big evil dragon, and there isn't really much... or like, you know what, I'm sorry, you know what the problem actually is that it climaxes early. The real antagonist is a human, whose arc comes to an end, and the denouement is just like kind of lackluster after that. But at the same time, like, there was just this feeling of like, no, I don't want to go away. I want to stay in this space. I want to keep going. And I think the first time I've had something, that feeling of like, that twinge in my chest since then was definitely Gravity Rush 2, actually, where you wrap that game up and it does a thing. I'm not going to spoil the ending. I'm not going to spoil like it. The third act of that game or the final act of the game is wild. It just goes to a very strange place. But then it does the thing where the credit sequence is brilliant and you're kind of seeing the world in a post ending space, and you're kind of like check, it does the kind of the JRPG thing of like, oh, we're gonna check in on some of the characters from the game, and then it ends on a question of, it ends on a nearly answered question of a sort of like, what happens to this character in the end? And then it kind of like ends on the reverse shot of whether or not you see that character, you know, the almost like graduate style, like, what's the truth, like, will things be okay in the end style, like waiting for the airplane ding, or I guess that's Say Anything is waiting for the airplane ding, sitting in the back of the bus is the graduate, very similar scene,
slowly pulling out,
The look of resignation and like regret on their faces, so good. But the thing that then happens is it reloads back to before the last act of the game. Not just the last mission, but the last act of the game. And so you're in this world that's like, okay, everyone's here. Everything's like, I can do all the side stuff, but no one knows what happens in the last act. And not having that post-game, I wanted to just be in that world again, having successfully won or whatever. And like having that world, but I had this world before the characters had finished the thing. And so, like, for whatever reason, that left me feeling really sad. Like, I wanted to live in the world that was good and complete and safe and, like, feel like I was just with people. And instead, I can never go back to that place to where I completed my task, and instead it would have to always be. And that's just, like, I couldn't get over that feeling. And so I just don't know that I'll ever play. I loved that game, but I don't know that I'll ever play more of it unless there's some sort of post-game DLC that I can jump to, which is strange, I know. But I think that's it for me, for sure.
Oh, man.
All right, so, yeah. Danielle, have you been looking at the most recent questions, the top of the bucket? We're going to try to mix old and new here.
Yeah, totally. I can see them. What about, like, 112.
Oh, do you want to go? Okay, so you want to see? I was going to go to the top.
Oh, do you want to go right at the top? You want to skim right off the top?
Someone who sent something in today. That's what I'm thinking.
Oh, shit. Well, we got 125. We got 126.
Okay, but those are still old. The ones that are actually new have not even gotten into the. They're just.
I'm going to my email then.
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm looking at. Exactly.
All right. See, I was looking at the cool notes.
I understand. And, we've been in the car all day.
You have an email like matrix.
We have a
that you're drawing.
You have no idea. It's complex.
And it's 125 questions deep.
It's way deeper than that. I mean, there's another.
Yeah.
What the hell kind of website?
It's real deep.
There's another.
This is terrifying. You know?
There's another probably 200 questions that need to get into this email bucket still. Totally. So.
Well, I got one from today. This is from Brian.
Ooh.
And Brian says, subject line, question, Zelda question, which is perfect.
Okay.
And Brian writes, hey, Waypointers. One of the best things about Breath of the Wild is how it eschews. I
Bless
always
you.
Say that wrong. Eschews.
Bless you.
The conventions. Thank you. Of recent previous entries in the series, or deconstructs them, as discussed on Idle Weekend. For many years, it has seemed like the success and popularity of Ocarina of Time has been holding back the series, as Nintendo feels the need to replicate Ocarina's structure in each new game. Breath of the Wild often gets compared to Zelda 1, but I think in many ways it's a fulfillment of what they wanted to do in Wind Waker. That game tried to be about a vast world of interesting corners to explore, but technical limitations meant that much of that vastness was an empty ocean, and historical convention meant that it still had to have traditional Ocarina-style progression structures, items, musical instruments, and dungeons. Now that Breath of the Wild has become so critically and commercially successful, I'm worried that it will simply become the new template that gets copied over and over. I can see a future where a new Breath of the Wild-alike is churned out every 3 years until we all hate it, the way Assassin's Creed has sort of gone. What do you hope to see for the future of the Zelda franchise? What lessons should Nintendo be learning from its success, and which parts of the game should they move on from or make way for something new and different? Love the show, Brian. Oh, what's a good one?
So, Rob, since you are the one who needs to step up to the mic and introduce yourself, what do you think? I know you haven't put much time or any time into Zelda yet. Is that true?
Oh, man. Let me tell you about me and Zelda.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I have not owned a Nintendo system since the SNES. So, for me, basically, there's only Link to the Past. And then there's a bunch of fake Zeldas.
Wow. Oh, boy.
Fake Zeldas.
Oh,
you
boy.
You went hard. You could have gone any way. This is your introduction to people, thousands of, tens of thousands of people who have no idea who you are.
Look, I have one of two options. I could either own it, and I could either, like, wrap myself in my ignorance, and then somehow, like, jujitsu that into being a source of strength. Or I could just say, hey, Austin, I'm completely unqualified to answer this question because I'm a PC gamer.
Oh my god, that's worse. Don't
that man. Oh boy. Oh boy.
Oh yeah, I'm winding up.
Oh boy. We hired a Danielle, we hired a PC gamer.
Yeah, we sure did.
No.
We sure did.
I play.
Has Nintendo considered just giving up on making their own consoles and releasing everything on PC?
You're just trying to get the hate
mail. So many people just closed their podcast app and wrote us a letter.
They just broke their phones, and now they're going to write us a letter saying, hey, give me a new phone, fire that Rob guy. But you can speak to the more general point here, because I don't think that that is a specific thing necessarily.
No, I mean, having not played Breath of the Wild, and like the more you guys talk about it, the more interested I am in it. But it definitely seems to me like there's been a weird dynamic with the Zelda series that I think is pretty spot on. It starts cropping up with Ocarina of Time, where half the audience seems to just want to recapture that game again and again and again. And the series can't help but fall short of it.
Mm-hmm.
But then the other half just want it to do something like to truly break from that past and stop even porting over so many of the elements of Ocarina of Time, the recognizable constituent parts of that game. So I think it's definitely, anytime you have a game that looms so large over a series, it's probably a little bit unhealthy, because both for the creator and the audience, it's going to sort of interpose itself between you and the thing you're trying to create.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something Nintendo struggled with for ages, but it sounds like for some reason they were able to sort of move past it with this most recent.
Yeah, I think they got a lot of new blood in creative positions, and that helped a lot of this with this particular game. I will say this for Brian. I do think Wind Waker actually does do a really good job of the vast world thing, and I don't think the ocean is as empty as a lot of people make it out to be. I also love Wind Waker and Majora's Mask equally. They are my beautiful children, and I love them, and they are the two Zelda games, at least 3D Zelda games, that have done the most with, you know, kind of changing things up a little bit and making good, I think, on the sense of adventure and the sense of weirdness and possibility that exists in this, you know, what is essentially an adventure, well, I guess puzzle combat adventure flow state simulators.
Uh-huh.
You can quote me on that one. That's a box quote right there. There's a succinct way of putting
it. The question, though, is, like, what about the rest of this thing? The sort of, like, what Nintendo at their GDC... talk called the chemistry engine, where, you know, different materials react differently to different elements, and elements can react on elements, and, you know, all that stuff, or the sort of the combat system that recalls things like Far Cry, any sort of, you know, we talk about emergent gameplay, we talk about interlocking systems, we talk about dynamic combat, stuff like that. Do you think that this is, you know, someone asked me a question on Twitter today, which was like, do you imagine that other designers are going to start pointing to Zelda, to Breath of the Wild, and saying, hey, publisher, we want to make a game that does something that Zelda did, and we want to move on it. We want to push it in this direction or push it in that direction. Do you see it worked for them? And that means that we should get the budget to do it for us. Do you imagine a world where that starts happening, or do you think that this is going to be the thing that, or do you think this is going to be like the Nemesis system, which is like a thing from Shadow of Mordor that we thought would be everywhere by now and still hasn't happened again?
Yeah, I mean, okay, I think honestly, first of all, I'm not as worried about Nintendo kind of just making a bunch of copies of their own game, because this shows a willingness to innovate, so mm-hmm. that's somewhat heartening. But in terms of other developers doing this, I don't know if we're going to get a whole bunch of Zelda-alikes, but I can imagine a world where people are like, well, maybe not quite the scope of this, but this element, the cooking is so cool, and maybe we'll make a game that uses the sort of cooking mechanics that actually is interesting and fun and has an element of discovery and an element of, you know, experimentation and sort of fun around that. Or maybe they'll do something with the combat in terms of, you know, different, the dynamics of combat that are kind of pulling more from Far Cry 2 than anything else. You know, the whole, well, you set that guy on fire, and then there was a bomb over here, but then this worked. Like, your story about convection especially was really, really fun with that. So I can totally see developers kind of cribbing a little bit of this, but I don't know if, almost no one has made a competent Zelda clone. I can think of, like, five decent examples of that, and considering how long-running the series is and how successful it is, it's just not really a style that all that many folks have really tried to emulate. So I guess I'm not as worried about that. I'm also not as worried when people take something that's really amazing and attempt to put their spin on it, because that's where we get good games a lot of the time.
That's one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot here, is a lot of what makes Breath of the Wild so great isn't just the dynamic combat, quote-unquote. Other games have done that before and have found niche audiences, or have found good-sized audiences, but have not wound up the kind of, like, 10 out of 10 in Metacritic, huge, you know, huge fandoms springing out of nowhere who are for the first time having an itch they didn't know that they had scratched, where they're, you know, I had a friend message me today who, you know, has played some Far Cry games and has, you know, played some Zelda games in the past, but it's never been like, she would never list that style of game as the number one favorite thing, telling me about how low on ammo and on weapons, she planted bombs near the where the kind of rack where the bokoblins kept their weapons, and then purposefully woke them up, and then when they ran to get their weapons, set the bombs off, killing most of them, and sending the rest of the weapons further away, so they would have to go even further to get the weapons. And it's like those sorts of stories come from this set of systems that interlock in a cool way, and but also in a sort of visual language that communicates the possibility space really cleanly, both through animation, through art design, through UI. And that's something that I can see a lot of people missing when they try to replicate these design things. Like, part of it is just having the resources to have a level of presentation and a focus on style that lots of teams won't be able to do. And that doesn't mean that the games won't be good, but it means that they may not have that same reach that Breath of the Wild managed to get. So I'm really curious to see how that shakes out. Like, I really hope. I mean, that's the other thing is, like, selfishly, I like this style of game a lot and have felt underserved, at least, by the market here. And so if this encourages more people to do things that, like, are all about me coming up with ridiculous plans that fall apart and then I'm scrambling to fix them and then I get knocked off a mountain and then, you know, one thing leads to another. Awesome, like, cool, and I'll enjoy it for the next 3 years, and then maybe it'll get played out, and I'll find some other thing along the way to start rallying around, and that's just life. Like, the old shit gets old, you know, the good stuff eventually becomes a little corny. There are jokes I don't do on Twitter anymore, not because I don't think that they were funny when I said them, but because the second someone else starts quoting you your own jokes back, it's time to bury them and find new jokes.
There it went,
There's a line between good joke and catchphrase, and, like, you don't want to be the comedian with catchphrases. You want to be the comedian who has new material. So I think that that's how I treat my fandom of games, too, is, like, I'm going to rally around this until... I'm going to rally around this. I'll never forget what a great time I had with it. It's going to be one of those games that when I finally put it down, I feel really a deep melancholy for that it's gone, or that I won't have the first experience again, to talk to Rob's point before about Last Express. But I'm also going to, like, try to move on and find new stuff that excites me. So, all right, Rob.
It's a good balance.
Give me another number from 1 to 125 or 126.
72.
Have you been thinking about this? Have you been... You don't have access to this document. That's an important thing to know.
It just popped in there.
This is you earn access to the email document based on your performance here today. So, 72. All right. This one comes in from Haratune, who says, or Haratian, maybe, hey, I haven't had any time to listen to your podcast since I'm working full-time and going to school. Do you have any tips or tricks for listening to podcasts while working and not getting distracted? Hope to hear an answer from you in a couple of years when I'm done with school. Thank you for writing in, Haratune. So you're like you mentioned, you're a bit of a podcast fan, Rob. How do you fit that into your schedule? Do you do it while you work? Do you do it in between work?
God, I can't do it while I work. Not at all.
I wish, right?
Like, this is... Yeah, so it's easy when I was working a crappy office job and wasn't invested in it all and had, like, it required no intellectual effort whatsoever. Then I could listen to all the podcasts I wanted. But, like, if I'm trying to write, it's hard when I'm listening to music where the lyrics are particularly, like, catching.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, you know, like, writing hip-hop generally don't go along unless I just, like, crank it and to a point where I'm just sort of, like, it becomes just, like, music, like, you know what I mean, just like sound, but it, like, it doesn't read as language anymore,
right?
Podcast though, it's like literally having other people, like, talking over you while you're trying to write. So yeah, that's just a non-starter. No, my prime podcasting time is cleaning the house, doing dishes, cooking, stuff like that. Like, you know, basically most like domestic tasks are accompanied by podcasts.
How about you, Danielle?
Mine is working out. I listen to the Myths and Legends podcast often when I'm doing workouts. I like hearing stories about folklore. That's just the thing I enjoy.
You don't find that takes you out of your groove?
Not when I'm doing particular types of workouts. So I'm a workout ridiculous. I just hit 20 years of not going.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
One day without working out as of March 1st, 2017. Got two decades here. So I have a whole slew of things. If I'm on my treadmill and I'm running hills, I'm watching fights. I'm watching like UFC fights or jiu-jitsu fights. Like I need something really intense. But if I'm doing abs, if I'm doing, sort of fairly basic lifting stuff, if I'm doing like a lot of pull-ups, push-ups, simple small weight lifting, that's perfect podcast time because it's kind of like a repetitive task in itself. It is almost like it feels a little bit like a menial task, even though I know obviously there's value in it. Just like doing a chore or something. So that works for me. But like, no, I mean, like if I'm fighting somebody or if I've got to do some serious, serious cardio, we need more intense stuff for that.
Yeah. For me, it ends up being, commute fodder. I have a pretty intense commute that can go anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour and a half, depending on how buses want to treat me that day. It works there. Or if I'm just doing stuff that the only time that I can do it well at work is when I'm doing stuff like grinding through emails where I just have to do
or invoices,
paperwork.
Invoices are a great time for podcasts.
Basic stuff that's like not using the creative aspect of my brain in any way, but it's still very important stuff to focus on. So that's probably it for me, I think. All right, let's do at least one more here. I'm gonna dig closer to the top again here. I see this question here has the word The Witcher 3 in it, so I'm going to read this one here from Andres, who says, "Hello, Waypoint. For the past couple of weeks, I've been thinking about The Witcher 3 and how I'm never going to play it. I've owned and had the game installed on my desktop for almost a year. I played the intro quest to this game 5 separate times, and after that, every other month, I'd start it up, stare at the main menu, then turn it off. This has left me with the same feeling I felt when I was 11 years old and attempted to read the Bible my parents had in their house. Frustrated and lost.
A worthy comparison.
The greatest story ever told, right? That's... I've decided that The Witcher 3 just isn't for me and have moved on. Have you guys ever felt this way or similar? I appreciate the response and I'm a huge fan of everything you do." So yeah, what's something that you've bounced off of, like, or you've tried a billion times and just couldn't ever commit?
I have this feeling about a lot of the Metal Gear Solid games.
Ooh,
like,
yeah.
Just the amount of stuff. And, like, I played a decent amount of 5 and enjoyed it. And I feel like 5 is probably maybe a bit on the more accessible side because it has a lot of other kind of stuff going on, for sure. And I was able to enjoy stealth in the desert, that sort of thing. But just in general, the weight of like, 30 years of lore and being incredibly, incredibly, incredibly lore heavy and cinematic, and knowing that I can't just do the thing where I can jump into The Witcher and play it for half an hour and feel like, oh, I got some time in there. I enjoyed my time there with The Witcher. I can play for 5 minutes with Zelda Breath of the Wild. I can cook some stuff. I can do things like that. I feel like I would need to set aside 10 hours to feel like I made any kind of actual impact in maybe one of the Metal Gear Solid games that wasn't 5 and had at least a little bit of that open world structure. It's just so intimidating to me, like, that there is this much stuff to understand and, get and be a part of to even feel like you've made any kind of dent of progress in that.
Yeah. How about you, Rob?
So, the problem is I'm very good at self-deception. So, for me, there's nothing I really bounced off of. There's just things that sucked, or things that I'm 100% in the process of interacting with and appreciating.
And you'll get there.
I just haven't gotten around to it. Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Yep.
So, like a pretty clear example, I guess, would be, oh shit, okay, I do have some examples. a lot of, like, classics of, like, the English lit canon. I just tend to crash on Takeoff. And I'll give you two examples. Most of Joyce.
Sure.
And the problem is, like, there are passages in Joyce that I think are some of my favorite in the English language. But, like, if you sit me down with Dubliners,
yeah,
I'm never going to make it to the Dead. Mm-hmm. It's just not going to happen. Because, and the problem is, the Dead, it sort of caps off the entire, like, it's the capstone of the entire work. Like, it sort of unifies the themes that have been told throughout all these short stories. The problem is, I don't care about any of those short stories.
So you're, like, you're even committed, you even need to read them in the order as collected. You can't even let yourself just get to the Dead.
No. Like, I mean, I graduated college, I've read the Dead.
Right.
You know, But no, I haven't made it, like, when I sit down to pick up Dubliners, I'm like, well, this time I'll start at the start of the collection. Mm-hmm. And it never works out. The other case is, T.S. Eliot, you feel like a genius when you're reading a Norton collected edition of, like, T.S. Eliot, and it's all annotated to shit. And, you know, all the references are sort of unpacked and explained, like, basically there's, like, half a verse, and then the rest of the page is notes and footnotes about, like, what it's referring to and all that, and you're like, oh, what a genius, and what a genius I am for appreciating this work. Problem is, at one point, on a whim, I bought I bought four quartets, so that was, I was going, like, I enjoyed reading T.S. Eliot so much in college, I'm going to read this. And some of it's really good. But the problem is, the edition I bought didn't have any annotations.
Oh, no.
And it turns out that if you don't have someone providing all the crib notes, T.S. Eliot is both obscure and nonsensical and also makes you feel profoundly dumb.
Yep.
and so there are parts of it I was able to get. There were parts of it where I was, like, cracking my Greek to English lexicon and, you know, sort of translating stuff and then figuring out what it was from. But I realized, like, I'm never going to read this stuff. Like, outside the context of a classroom assignment, I'm never going to get into this guy's work because I just don't want him to work all... I don't want to work this hard.
I totally understand. For me, like... the thing isn't that I don't want to work so hard to unwrap a specific single work. It's like it ends up being about, like, pure time investment for a thing that is really long or very vast. Yeah. So, like, if we can talk outside of games, like, I feel like the discography of like Sufjan Stevens is someone who I, like, all of my friends really like his works, and my favorite musicians really like his work. He has too many albums, and I'm the sort of person who's like, well, I have to start from the beginning. I have to start from the beginning, and I have to listen to every album completely. I can't just go to the ones that people say are very good. I have to start from the beginning. And similarly, there are things in games like that where, like, I've never beaten a Stalker game, and I would love those games. I've gotten 6 hours maybe into the first one, into Shadow of Chernobyl. Is that the first one?
Austin.
I know.
Let me tell you.
I know.
Let me tell you. Like, as somebody with a deep appreciation and understanding of the Zelda series.
Okay.
Everything that you could possibly enjoy about Breath of the Wild, I am confident Stalker was doing probably better.
I put 4 or 5 hours into the first Stalker game with the complete mod and without the complete mod. I played through that the first 4 or 5 hours both ways. I got to the city both times, the bar both times. I did a bunch of stuff in the open world beforehand. Really loved it. And then just each time just like, but I could go play this instead. I can't imagine ever find the time to really dig into it the way I'm supposed to or the way I would like to. Which is a shame because I would love putting more time into those games. It just feels to some degree like the door has closed, which is not a great feeling to have.
Terrible feeling. We're gonna have to fix that.
I would love to.
But do I have to play the Assassin's Creed games? Because, like, no. I have friends who are like, man, I got so attached to Ezio. Like, that story pays off in so many ways. And so I've basically been frozen with the series.
Play 2, and then maybe Black Flag a little.
Brotherhood's really good. You know? Like, those are things, I think 2 is pretty good.
I heard Brotherhood was good. You're right. I like Brotherhood. I heard Syndicate was good, too.
Listen, let me tell you about Syndicate. I heard good Assassin's things about that Creed Syndicate. Syndicate you mean.
Yeah, yes. Yes, well, that's what we're talking about, right?
Well, okay.
There's lots of Syndicates out there. I know.
Rob, we have to play some Snake.
No, we do.
And then the other big one, the biggest one, is probably competitive games in general. Fighting games, esports.
Yeah.
I've installed and uninstalled Dota, and I've installed and uninstalled Blizzard All-Stars. What's that called?
Wow.
Blizzard All-Stars?
Heroes of the Storm.
Blizzard All-Stars.
Yeah, Blizzard All-Stars. That's it. Heroes of the Storm. Wasn't it briefly called Blizzard All-Stars? Am I just making that up? It
I
was.
Think you might just.
No, be, it was formerly it? Blizzard Dota.
That makes
and
me
then
really
Blizzard,
happy.
And then Blizzard All-Stars. Right, Heroes of the Storm. It's late. We've been in a car for 30 hours today.
Yeah, pretty much.
I have Heroes of the Storm installed in 3 computers right now. So, like, I know I should try it, but I just don't have the belief in myself to be able to comprehend it at a level that I could start enjoying it. So, that's also one for me, I think. And that's going to be my white whale for a long time. We'll see. We'll see.
Oh boy.
All right, let's do one more.
I've got a pretty good one, actually, from the recent pile.
Oh, really? So you've gone into that part of the bucket. Which one are you looking at?
It's the one about us saying things suck that people like.
Oh.
Like Tom Brady? Like that one? Does it?
Was Tom Brady
the greatest
in there?
Quarterback okay. who ever played the game?
Who's the email from?
Matthew Mills.
This comes from Matthew Mills from Nova Scotia. Hey, everyone at Waypoint, I hope you're doing well. I wanted to write in about something that's been on my mind for a while now and was reminded about in one of the most recent episodes of your podcast. I apologize for the length of this email, but this was rather difficult to put into words. During the plethora of discussions about Zelda going on in your podcast, as well as many other sources of games media, the topic of Twilight Princess being bad, quote-unquote, has come up dozens of times. Personally, that is my favorite Zelda and the only one I've ever finished. In the same episode of your podcast, you called out a couple of other things bad that I quite enjoy, one being the anime Sword Art Online and the other being the book Ready Player One. Now, I'm not here to shout out to the rooftops about how I believe these pieces of media are the greatest or how you're all wrong. You're not. After all, I'm sure you're just sharing your opinion. However, I noticed quite a few years ago that my favorite movies, books, etc. fall into the quote-unquote bad category so many of my peers and those I look up to. Every time this happens, when people say anime is bad, I begin to feel isolated. I start to ask myself, is there something wrong with me? Why did I like it when no one else I know does? Is there actually something wrong with the game? Is there some sort of discriminatory idea represented that I miss? Probably not, but I start to feel put down. After all, a large part of our identities come from the things we like and the things that we incorporate into our lives. While I respect and enjoy listening to your opinions and views on the state of games and the world at large, I can't help but feel a little bullied or trolled when an offhand comment about a game I liked sucking or being bad is uttered. I try to remind myself that you're probably only joking or at least simply being hyperbolic about your views, but I still can't help but wince. I realize this isn't exactly a question, but I wanted to share this view with you and see what you thought. Have you ever felt this way? Did you do something about it, or did you just brush it off and move on? Thanks so much for the great work you do. Despite the times that I die a little inside. Matthew Mills, Nova Scotia. That's a fantastic question, and it's something that definitely has bugged me in the past as a listener to other things, where, like, someone says something, and then another podcaster is like, well, that sucks, and then moves on. So I definitely mea culpa for doing that. That said, I also, what I really wish we had was more time to go into those things. And maybe we could also do a better job of pausing each other and asking to elucidate or expand on some of this stuff. You know, like, I can tell you why I think Ready Player One is not only a book I don't like, but is a book that is bad. It just requires 20 minutes that we often don't have. And that's, like, a difficult thing. And also, it doesn't require us to dig into what we mean when we say bad versus a thing I don't like. Like, how are we talking about subjective taste? I guess another way for me to talk about those things is to say that I don't think that they succeed at this or that. Or again, like, the more precise we get is the better the criticism is going to actually be, or the more useful or productive it's going to be.
Yeah, and also, Twilight Princess is actually a really, really good 25-hour game. It's just right. inside a 50-hour game.
Right.
Like, there's actually wonderful, wonderful stuff in there, and I hope in times I've written about it and so on and so forth, like, there's a lot of value there, and I think there's a lot of value in a lot of things that I would call, you know, especially in the past when I've been a little more, I don't know, insensitive about this sort of stuff. Like, well, that sucks.
Right.
I am trying at this point in my life to be like, you know what? Not for me, but go with God, my friend. Like, you know, like, if it makes you happy, if you get joy from it, and this is not a thing that is like, you know, I would reserve the, is it actively making people act in a shitty way or, you know, really punching down at people kind of thing. In that case, I would be like, no, you know what? Maybe it sucks a little right. bit. But, like, if something is not harming people and is a fun and happy pursuit, like, you know, you do you. you know what? You enjoy. Yeah, and it's fine to enjoy things. It's fine to love things that other people look down on. Like, I have many places in my heart. We've talked about this many times on Idol Weekend, but there's a show that I truly love. It's called Lost Girl, and it is the trashiest fucking trash ever put to television, and I adore it. And it's made with, like, you know, a $2 budget. It's a goofy, sexy, like, supernatural series made with no money whatsoever, and it's wonderful, and I love it, but I can completely understand why 99% of people on Earth would look at that and just laugh their asses off. Like, I get it. And I think we all have stuff like that, totally. Right? Even if it's not even what you would call a guilty pleasure. I wouldn't call that a guilty pleasure at all. I just love it. Like, I don't feel guilt. It's great. You know, like, in my opinion. So, yeah. I think that's worth saying, too. Like, it's okay to like things.
It's okay to like things that other people don't. I do...
Yeah.
It's so tough because sometimes the issues... It's tough in this instance because of how I feel strongly about both Ready Player One and Sword Art Online.
Sure.
To the degree that I want to be able to talk to this person and explain why I don't like them. Because I don't want to come across as just having disregard for them. But I also, like... I have a good friend from college who I basically never talk to anymore because the thing we bonded over was being elitist assholes, right? Was liking movies from directors that most of our peers didn't know and liking music from artists who hadn't released anything in 15 years and liking, you know, books that were really hard to read. And I was just like the worst. Like from 19 till 24, I was the worst person to be around. And when I hang out with that person now, he immediately drops right back into that like bit of like that exact mode of being, and like it's instantly just dunking on everyone we know. And like, no, I'm not gonna laugh at this person who liked the Avengers 3 or whatever. Like, I know I don't like it. I know I'm not going to enjoy it. I know that I'm really frustrated in Rise of Ultron when Tony Stark. Like, the way to beat Ultron is just to make another better Ultron, and, like, that says nothing about, like, the core conflict that, like, maybe American arms manufacturing and belief in startup culture isn't the way to go. And, like, but also, I'm not gonna dunk on my other friend who really had a good time at Rise of Ultron, if that's even the name of the movie, I forget.
Yeah, Ultron something.
Definitely Ultron was, that guy was there. That guy was definitely there. with James Spader, who was pretty good, frankly.
Well, he's sort of been playing that, like, he didn't have to reach real far.
No, he's just playing his Blacklist character.
It was there.
But what if he was a robot? So,
yeah.
So I definitely, like, the Blacklist was definitely a thing that I watched a bunch of, started to dislike, but would never, like, make fun of somebody for liking. And so... I think I wouldn't because I get the joy from that sort of
questions, Austin. I would have questions,
but those are different questions for me than like someone who is going to go to bat for this moment of like transphobia in The Legend of Zelda: Breath of the Wild, or for someone who's going to go to
bat. That's where harm comes in
for the jingoism of Ghost Recon Wildlands. Who isn't just saying I know about these issues and I still like it. Who isn't just saying like, yeah, I know that Ready Player One is mostly driven by a sort of empty nostalgia, and that it has like some really shitty gender politics, and it has like some issues with like friend zoning in a weird way, and the reduction of relationships to being almost like currency exchange. And I know that it's just this kind of empty male power fantasy, but I really love what it does with its world building. Like, I'm okay with that. But the thing that's really tough for me is when given those criticisms, someone just says, like, no, you're wrong, it's just good. And that's, like, the opposite of this thing. And so what I should be better about is giving those specific critiques, which then would demand specific responses, even if that's just, like, yeah, I know, but, like... Cool fucking laser swords, man. Like, and like, yeah, you're right. Cool fucking laser swords. Like,
those are cool lasers.
Ready Player One does have that shit with like all of the way people live in the future is one trailer stacked on top of another trailer forever, and that's a really cool image. You're totally right. Yeah. I think we need to all of us get better at both explaining why we like things and also maybe why we don't, or not worry about it. Like, I don't know. I think worrying about it's probably productive.
Yeah, I think worrying about it's productive. It's just a question of there certainly is a massive amount of this that is just what is the purpose and point of entertainment in a person's yeah. life? Is it going to that point of like self-identifying as a type of person because of the entertainment they're watching, or is it kind of like, this is the thing that I do to chill out? Like, I think there's also that aspect of it as well, that kind of plays into you.
As an audience member, you have to own that. Like,
yeah.
this is, I guess, where I come down on this is, it's okay to, like, when I hear somebody bagging on something that I love, and I'm trying to think of if there's stuff that like I really adore that I know I'm completely out there on. Like I consume a lot of crap media, definitely. Like, I'm fully aware that a lot of CW shows inevitably sure. jump the shark, probably a lot sooner than I finish watching them. But I still keep going. But and let's not even get started on my weird crusade around Kane and Lynch. And then giving that the place it deserves in the critical discourse. But I think when I hear people really just going hammer and tongs on something I love, after that initial sort of like revulsion, right? The sort of like the shock of like, you know, having your tastes almost slapped, like usually my response after that is to try to figure out where they're coming from.
Right.
And if I can see it, then I can start to unpack, well, okay, did I just miss this stuff? Like, was I just so naive I missed that, like, fundamentally this thing that I thought was good actually is pretty disastrously flawed? Or was I responding to other qualities that maybe its critics aren't adequately appreciating? And I think your enjoyment of this stuff, sometimes hearing these critiques, you're going to go cold on stuff. There's a lot of genre sci-fi that I loved as a kid that I cannot get back into. I read between the ages of like 10 and 19, I must have read every Michael Stackpole book two or three times.
Oh yeah.
Rogue Squadron, Battletech, yep. All that shit. Loved it to pieces. And it was like somebody flipped a switch. I went back and I reread some of that stuff, like, in my mid-20s, and it was almost paint-by-numbers, like, genre fiction. And it became kind of a dead thing. It was kind of heartbreaking to me.
Well, we've talked on Three Moves Ahead.
But this, by the way, doesn't happen with Aaron Alston's Wraith Squadron books, by the way. Just one side out there.
Yeah.
Those hold up.
You know, I mentioned when I was on that episode of Three Moves Ahead a while ago, like, this was the 4X for me, where, like, I grew up playing 4X strategy games, and then somewhere in my late teens, early 20s, I lost my taste for conquering things in strategy games. And, like, don't begrudge people who still put hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours into Civ. Don't judge them for it. But, like, the notion of I'm going to expand, exploit, exterminate, and the one that I've explore I'm still into, but those other ones,
the nice one.
But like those things fail to flip the switch. It's not that they fail to flip the switch, it's that my like misgivings about the notion of a world primed for capture, that like that so many 4X games are built on that concept that like, okay, well, we all started at the same time and it was just a race to see who could go get the best stuff. It sits really poorly with me, and if I feel like I'm being hyperbolic here, you should go look at the Three Moves Ahead episode where we dig deep into this stuff.
The 4X malaise.
Yeah, the 4X malaise episode. Yeah, exactly.
Featuring quotes from Werner Herzog.
True. That is true. Werner Herzog does make an appearance.
But some of the stuff, though, you're going to hear all these critiques, and you're going to also realize that there's still shit there that you love, and you just fundamentally, on some level, don't care because you see what you love, you know it's there, and you can still appreciate it. And then I think that's a good thing, too. Like, it's perfectly fine being aware. Like, I think everyone tends to overuse, and I'm guilty of this as well, so overuse the expression, like, guilty pleasure, right? That, like, oh, I have this thing I enjoy, but, like, I'm ashamed of it and I know I shouldn't. No, actually, I think what we mean by guilty pleasure a lot of times is you're aware of its shortcomings. You're aware of the places where it's sort of half-assing its approach to more difficult concepts. But it is paying off on some, like, primal, fundamental levels that you just don't give a damn. And you're going to celebrate. Like, and that's not an easy thing. Like, doing good genre work, doing stuff tough. That just... Yeah, 100%. There's this great interview that Glixel had, I think, with Rob Dabbio, who, you know, disclosure, is a personal friend, but he's a board game designer, designed the designed Risk Legacy and Pandemic Legacy. Most of this interview centers around his work, working at Hasbro,
right,
on family party games. And what's fascinating reading that interview is you might think that, like, oh, this is the story of, like, oh, all those shitty wasted years where he's working on these crappy family party games and his art, his opus is still out there, but he's not allowed to do it. And what I love about this interview is he has this real respect for games like that, for things that deliver these simple pleasures that may not work for you if you're, you know, a Eurogame connoisseur or something like that, but it's still hard to make a game that's going to work with the family gather around the table with an audience of 65 down to 80.
Right.
And you have to, respecting that craft and understanding it makes you better across the board. Mm-hmm. And I think something similar is happening with, you know, this sort of media. When there's a lot of stuff that is satisfying, but it's naive or it's immature. But some of it does hold up in spite of those flaws. And it's valuable to understand why that holds up.
The one thing I do want to add here is, you know, part of what the emailer who wrote in said was, you know, attacks on the media I like sometimes can feel like an attack on me because I identify with this stuff. And I have been in that place so, so clearly. Like, that's me at 15, 13, 14 through 25 feeling bad anytime anyone said anime was bad. Or anytime anyone said a rapper I liked was bad, or anytime anyone said a movie I like, it's forever. It's anytime somebody said that D&D was bad when I was deep into D&D, and I understand that relationship now. Maybe because I'm a little bit more removed from it, or I think really the thing that ended up happening for me is eventually my love was dispersed across enough things that even if I still identified with them, there was always some other thing that I could hold my hang my hat on, and that because I was I wasn't so invested in a single thing, the punches don't sting as much. And you know, along the way, I ended up being invested, instead of being invested in a specific thing, I became invested in a style or a mode of enjoyment or a mode of expression or not just a specific thing, but a genre, not just a genre, but a broader tone. It's not just that I like magical. It's not just that I like Murakami. It's that I like magical realism. It's not just that I like Satoshi Kon. It's that I like anime more broadly. And so when someone attacks, you know, when someone says like, "Oh, Paranoia Agent is really pretentious." Like, okay, like, fuck off, who cares? I also like, you know, I don't only like Satoshi Kon, I don't only like Paranoia Agent. In fact, even inside of Kon's own work, I can point to other things that are maybe less pretentious or that are less psychological and can still, like, revere him as a creator and not feel like I have to come to his defense every time. I think that's a thing that partially has to do with age and experience, and then partially has to do with really putting forward the effort to find ways to identify and value yourself and not only your relationship with media and consumer goods, you know? I used to also identify with the shoes I had and with the, you know, with, like, making sure that I had cool shit. And, like, I'm not saying that I don't still want cool shit, but, like, I'm not going to get into a fist fight because someone insulted my sneakers anymore. I'm not that kid. Like, I was that kid once, and I don't have to be that kid anymore. So I think that's the other end of the, like, yes, have as Rob said, like, a really healthy relationship with the stuff that you love, and, like, don't feel guilty about liking things that other people don't like, as long as you're engaged with it. But then also, like, let yourself have some distance from the things that you love, and understand that you're valuable in and of yourself, separate from what anybody thinks about the anime you watch or the music you listen to. I think that's, for me, the way I got to be a little more, a little less defensive about the things I love.
I'm nodding furiously. You can't see it because this is an audio podcast, right. But I am nodding right along.
And we are not live streaming. I think that might do it for us. Nope. We went a little longer than I thought. So we're all nodding along here. If you have questions, if you want your questions to get into the question bucket and to be read here on Waypoint Radio, you should send them to gamingadvice.com. Use the subject questions. You can put some other words in there if you want, but that's how it'll get into the questions label where we'll see it. So that would help. Rob, where can people find you on the internet?
They can find me at twitter.com/RobZachney.
An easy one.
Yeah.
What about you, Danielle?
You can find me at DanielleRI, and I'll just say this. I think Rob did well, and I think he can keep his job.
Yeah, hey, I'm all for it. I think you could stay on. I'll even give you access to the deep.
I'm really sorry about the Nintendo thing, guys. I'm super sorry.
We'll cut it. Tim, don't cut it. Don't cut it at all. Leave it in.
Tim, keep it in.
You can find me on Twitter at Austin_Walker. You can find everything that Waypoint does at waypointadvice.com, at bazinga.zone, at digitalpyramids.com, at new.donk.city, at waypoint.dog.arf, or it might be waypoint.arf.dog. I can't ever recall. It's one or the other. I believe there's a Poplio one in there. You can find us on Twitter at twitter.com/waypoint, Facebook at facebook.com/waypointvice, youtube.com/waypointvice. Please, if you liked the show, send us a note, but also go to your iTunes or your Google Play or whatever other podcast server that you get this from and give us a rating. We'd really appreciate that. And as always, I would like to thank our great friend, our great musician friend, Bowen, who provided the theme to our show. Miss You off of the EP Pale Machine. You can find out more info about Bowen at waypoint.zone/BOEN. We will catch you after PAX. If you're at PAX, let us know. Maybe we'll see you. We're doing a couple panels. Danielle, what panel? What are you up to?
I'm going
to
be on 404 in it, breaking down the internet Friday at 7:30. And I'm also going to be part of the wonderful lunacy that is PAXomania on Saturday.
That's Saturday afternoon sometime?
Saturday afternoon. Yeah, I think it's at 4 p.m.
That sounds right.
I believe.
And then
be around. You'll see things.
You may have already missed this, but I'm in a panel tomorrow, or I'm in a panel today, Friday the 10th, from 1 to 2, called Does the Author's Intent Matter in Video Games, along with some great people, including Alexandra Van Chestine, Catherine Cross, and Tanya X Short. So, really great. Really looking forward to doing that panel. But this might go up after that's already happened.
In which case, you did great, Austin. I bet it was awesome.
I hope so.
You really killed the author.
I'm going to talk about Barth. I'm going to talk about algorithms and labor. Those are my notes.
Good old buddy Roland.
Roland Barth. my notes say, my notes include this great joke, original concept of Dota, and then I have in parentheses, death of the author, because I'm incredibly clever.
Oh, God.
Oh, it's so good.
Maybe that'll kill. Maybe it won't. We'll see. New material. I didn't have a chance to go through Boston comedy clubs and see if this stuff will play, but we'll find out tomorrow.
You can spin that chair right around and be like, hey, kids.
Yeah.
Have you heard of the original Dota?
Death of the Author. God. Let me tell you about the first instance of jungling. Let me tell you about post-colonialism. All right, that's going to do it for us this week at Waypoint. Thank you again for tuning in, and check us out on Monday when we will be back to our old shenanigans coming to you live from Brooklyn. It sounds like our studio is done, so you'll have to tune in and see if that's true. Until then, peace.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.